for antiwar.com and Chaos Radio 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas. I'm Scott Horton, and this is Anti-War Radio. No nation has ever fought a war in the manner it predicted. So says my guest today, Gabriel Kolko. He's professor emeritus at York University in Toronto, and he's joining me on the phone from Amsterdam in the Netherlands. Welcome to the show, sir.
Thank you.
It's great to talk to you. Now, everyone, Gabriel Kolko is a historian and an incredibly accomplished author. Check out this list of books. The World and United States Foreign Policy, 1943 through 45.
Oh, you better stop. We'll spend all our time with titles. I've written 14 books.
14 books. And the most famous of those being, I think, The Triumph of Conservatism, A Reinterpretation of American History, 1900 through 1916. And the most recent, and the topic of this interview, is The Age of War, The United States Confronts the World. And that's good that you stopped me, because you're right, it would have taken 10 minutes to get
through them all. No, it would have taken all our time off. And let's talk about The Age of War, because there's plenty there to take a program.
Oh, absolutely. Well, And the Age of War, basically, if I can attempt to sum it up, it tells the story of the American government's futile attempt to rule the planet since World War II. And if I may say, you seem to describe the U.S. imperial project kind of as a giant, blind and deaf, stumbling around, killing people almost without purpose, searching for a doctrine to excuse the violence that is being committed regardless.
Well, to some extent, that's their problem. They're not the only country that's had that kind of mentality. There have been countries in the past that have thought they should basically run the world. The British had it in the 19th century. The French had it too. And the Germans had it briefly, et cetera, et cetera. The problem, and then, of course, the Soviet Union had it in the name of international proletariat. The problem is that as a result of this, go back to 1919 and thereabouts, the Middle East was redrawn between British and French imperialism. It's a very fragile region, and the borders put on the Ottoman Empire, which was defeated, were really quite arbitrary, and they didn't respect national boundaries, ethnic boundaries, no boundaries at all. They were arbitrary. And there is, in the Middle East, a unique, colossal mess, more than in Indochina and more than anywhere else. The United States has now entered into the legacy of rival imperialisms. It is itself an imperialist power, and as a result, it's found itself with far more difficulty on its hands than it can handle. And that, of course, is the story of Iraq, and that's the story of Afghanistan, and that's the story of the whole region. The consequences are much greater than Vietnam. This is a war that will break the United States as an imperial entity.
Which, in the end, will not that it's necessarily worth all the innocent human lives that have been taken, but in the end, will probably save more lives. And we'll all probably be better off, right?
Well, let's make our position clear. I don't think any nation of the world, whether it's the United States or the Soviet Union or England, should muck around with the affairs of other states. It turns out very badly. It has for the United States. That is to say, the United States has interfered in the Middle East since the late 40s. There was a government in Persia, Iran. It was secular, it was middle class, it was nationalist too, but it was accused of being communist, and it was overthrown in 1953 by the CIA and British intelligence, and the result was the Shah, and the result of the Shah, of course, was the resurrection of Islamic fundamentalism. And the United States encouraged Islamic fundamentalism as a way of coping with what it called a greater menace of communism. It did so in Afghanistan. As a result of the United States' fooling around in 1953, Iran is now an enemy. and it will be far, far worse than if the United States had simply left the country pursue its own lights and do whatever it wanted for itself. Now, this wouldn't have eliminated problems in no area of the world. Will there ever be a situation where there are no problems? But the United States has shown itself completely incapable of regulating these problems, and all it does is more harm than good, and now, of course, it's endangered itself because all the world hates it. In this context, the Pew Research Organization has released a global report, but the view of the United States' influence of the world is mainly negative. It's gone up in the last 2 years from 46% to 52%. Most of the people dislike what the United States is doing. Now, the American public dislikes what George Bush is doing, and so he's been defeated at the in the last elections. And the war on the vote, it was a referendum on the war, he said so. The war vote has shown that the American public doesn't like it either. And they're much more quickly than after the Vietnam War hostile to the various undertakings that the United States has embarked upon. That doesn't make much difference. He's ignored the people, but that's where we are at the present moment.
Well, and this is all based off of really World War II, and the book covers the entire post-war era. And basically, not only did America inherit all of our enemies and even our allies' empires, minus the Soviet Union's empire, at the end of World War II, but this is also kind of the founding myth of American power as a force for good in the world, right? We defeated those dastardly Japanese and the personification of all evil in the Third Reich, and so therefore we prove just how good it is to use American military power to intervene in other countries' affairs, even leading up all the way into the Iraq War, where the discussion, basically the imagination of our leaders apparently had it that we were going to be treated like our soldiers were in France when they liberated France from the Nazis in the 40s.
Yeah, you see, there's one underlying factor in American foreign policy since the end of the Second World War, and that's fear. First of all, there was fear of the Soviet Union and communism. And that fear is necessary, first of all, to mobilize the public, because the public simply wants to drink its beer and be left alone. And it's necessary to mobilize the Congress, because originally Congress was there to balance the budget, and it's been running the United States government has been running a deficit, so now it has an $8 trillion debt. When the Soviet Union and communism disappeared, as people like George Kennan and the CIA said it would in 1990, they simply replaced the fear of communism with the fear of terrorism. Now, this scraggly bunch of people who the United States says will invade, or George Bush says will invade the United States and end freedom, etc., it's a joke. But you must understand that this underlying element of fear is really quite consistent. What the United States has done, of course, it's gone to war in Afghanistan, and it's gone to war in Iraq. And what it's shown is that the American way of war is basically a failure. They don't shock and awe their enemies. In Afghanistan, the Taliban is becoming stronger after 5 years. In Iraq, according to the National Intelligence Estimate issued a few days ago, they have an utter disaster. Politically, there's chaos at home. Israel is coming apart. It's a complete disorder. The American way of war has not been successful because it's a purely military approach to problems.
Well, and it's been that way since World War II, right? We're not talking about our military's ability to defend us from other nation states. We're talking about our military's ability to go in and dominate these third world countries, put down their insurrections, and occupy them. And
well,
it's very ineffective for that.
Well, that was shown most graphically in Vietnam. But in Korea, the United States fought to a draw, and John Foster Dulles and his successor said it would never happen again. Well, it did happen again. And in Vietnam, they lost the war. They lost the war despite the fact that they spent far more money than the Vietnamese. And they had absolute mastery of the skies, and the helicopters began being shot out of the skies there. I should say the loss of four helicopters in Iraq in the last 2 weeks has been very, very disturbing, because once you lose your helicopters, you've lost your mobility.
Right.
But the American way of warfare simply doesn't work. That is to say, we've laid out enormous amounts of money to fight essentially the Soviet Union, to fight technocentric, urban-centric societies, and to destroy them. And the reality in Vietnam, the reality in Korea, and of course the reality in Iraq and elsewhere, is that your enemies are poor and they're decentralized, and your wars are basically futile. Now, there are a lot of people in the Pentagon, particularly in the Army, who feel this way, and I think the Army Strategic Studies Institute just a few weeks ago issued a very interesting report by Kevin Reynolds. The CIA has said this all along. You know, you can't eat soup with a fork. The American way of warfare is essentially dysfunctional. It's also very expensive. That is to say, in the process of doing all this, they're bankrupting the American economy. So the American dollar is now falling in value.
Professor, let me stop you right there, because you hit on about 10 or 15 different points we could discuss here. Let's save some of the economic consequences and even save some of our current Middle East stuff until later. I want to go back and talk about the Cold War. You talked about the level of fear that was built up in the country in order to justify the arms buildup for the Cold War. And I guess I wonder how cynical and dishonest the fear-mongering by our leaders was back then. Did they believe their own propaganda about the imminence of Soviet takeover of the Earth? They believed their own domino theory, for example?
No. This deliberately cultivated fear-mongering started with the Truman Doctrine of March 1947, and Truman was told by both George Marshall and Acheson and various people that it simply wasn't going to happen. Communism was not going to take over Europe or the world, and this was simply fear-mongering. And the CIA has been very, very useful, because they hire some very analytically sophisticated people, in telling these people in the White House and in the executive branch what they're saying is wrong. I mean, they were warned by the CIA against the Vietnam venture. They were warned not to support the French. They said that Ho Chi Minh was, and the communists, so-called, were just nationalists. And there's been an element of cynicism based on this need, as John Foster Dulles said, to keep fear alive. That is to say, the moment the American public relaxes, then it's all gone. And the moment the Congress relaxes, then they're not going to run up deficits. They're going to balance the budget, which they threatened to do in 1946. So there's an element of cynicism which defies imagination. And it's all revealed, if you read various accounts, it's all revealed in memoirs. The best book, I think, is this book by Matthias. I can't remember his first name, but he was the head of the Soviet Estimates Division of the CIA. And Matthias said, look, whenever there was a need to pass a budget, we had to emphasize the Soviet menace. Mm-hmm. We were not allowed to report independently. We were not allowed to speak the truth. So there's always been a certain cynicism.
Wasn't there a letter from a senator to Harry Truman saying, you got to scare the hell out of him, Harry?
Right.
Go out there and tell him communism's going to take over the whole world if
right.
we don't stop him.
And that's exactly what he said with the Truman Doctrine. It simply wasn't true. The first place, communism itself was very weak. and that it disappeared was predicted by George Kennan, and it disappeared in the 1990, and of course everyone was astonished, but it no longer exists in the world.
Well, and you say in the book that it was never even really a threat, but in fact you say it was, quote, simply the reflection of the West's bad ideas. What do you mean by that?
Well, communism and fascism would never have existed, and they were out of the question. I mean, Lenin was a crank. He was he lived in Zurich. If it had not been for the First World War, that is to say, the First World War traumatized a lot of people, and the Second World War traumatized a lot of people. And communism was a reflection. It wasn't the cause of those wars. And to the extent we're talking about a passive derivative system, a system which basically reflects the breakdown of Western civilization. And this civilization is worth maintaining, but it's not going to be maintained by George Bush, and it's not going to be maintained by the hawks at the rate we're going. The danger now, of course, is that there'll be such a conflagration in the Middle East that it will all come to an end. Now, what's happening at the present moment in the last few days is that there are a lot of Israelis who are saying, look, we've locked ourselves into a mad project, the Iranian bomb. There'll be a report released next Wednesday, according to Haaretz today, which says, look, what's an Iranian bomb mean to us? We have 200 of our own. It'll be a deterrence relationship. But basically, because the Syrians want to sign a peace treaty now, and this is what Baker knew about when he passed his report to the president saying he should negotiate with Syria and Iran, there are really now a lot of allies of the United States that say we are better off alone. And George Bush and his ilk are of the same sort of mentality that created disasters after 1914 and after 1945. And the challenge now for Americans is to get rid of these kinds of people and to replace politics with something more rational and something which takes account of the nature of the world.
And I think that's a very important point, that communism in the Soviet Union and Nazism in Germany were direct results of the violence of World War One, that these were, well, as you say, reflections, perversions of what anybody would have ever thought was a good idea if there had not been fire raining from the air.
Well, the First World War, 1914, I consider the original sin, if there ever was an original sin. But what we have now, of course, is we have a group of people who have found out that this is marketable politically, and with the exception of Tony Blair, no one believes in this anymore. We have someone in England who believes in the imperial mission, but the United States is now alone in the world, and the CIA has gone over this and issued some, I think, very acute analyses in which they say the world is essentially moving, one of their recent reports is a fundamental restructuring of the global order. The Chinese are now very, very powerful. They have the most foreign reserves of any country in the world. They have almost $1 trillion. The United States is simply going to have to learn to live with the rest of the world. And they no longer can define for regions what they're going to do with themselves. Now, the problem, of course, is that it's completely preoccupied with the Middle East, and the issues there are very grave. But the issues are just as grave in South America, where the United States is losing control, and in Africa and elsewhere. And in a sense, we have a problem of an intrusive power that wants to be great and simply can't do so. No one wants to be pushed around in Europe, at least, and in Asia, and the United States simply is not in a position to do so. Not economically, because after the Second World War, it had a monopoly of economic power. It no longer has it anymore. The euro is now more important as a trading trading currency than the dollar, and the year of the United States is over, and that means that the Americans can live in peace and freedom. And if they live in peace and freedom and don't muck around, the world will cease to hate them. And if they cease to hate them, there's much less likelihood of terrorists coming and blowing up buildings than there ever was.
Well, this doctrine of the centrality of power on Earth during the Cold War, the power was basically divided in two, and you say in your book that Brent Scowcroft, George Bush Sr.'s national security advisor, was opposed even to the breakup of the Soviet Union. They were afraid of what would happen.
Well, they looked upon the elimination of the Soviet Union with a great deal of trepidation. Now, the reasons for that are very complicated, because essentially the Soviets were playing the game with them. That is to say, if there were rebellious nations and rebellious forces, the communists tried to keep them in tow. And the loss of communist hegemony over various movements poses a much greater threat. So when Scowcroft and others of that period, the 1990s, expressed their concern, they really meant that the ballpark was now loose. There were too many players. It was very predictable when the Soviet Union ran things. It was very predictable when they had influence in Eastern Europe and the Middle East. But there's been far more conflict since the disappearance of communism than afterwards. And to describe the nature of the enemy is very difficult, because it's very diverse. It's very different in various places. In Afghanistan, you're dealing with Islamic fundamentalists. You're dealing with this and that and everything. In Somalia, you're dealing with warlords. In South America, you're dealing with people who cite Jesus Christ as the authority for Venezuelan socialism, 21st century socialism. So the world is much more complicated, and the United States simply can't cope with it.
I'm Scott Horton. This is Anti-War Radio. I'm talking with Professor Gabriel Kolko. He's the author of The Age of War, The United States Confronts the World. And a big part of the book, the theme really running throughout this book, is America's reliance on technology to try to accomplish its unlimited aims and goals. And you say in the book that at the onset of the Cold War, that America didn't even really need Western Europe's help in order to defeat the Russians in Western Europe, because if it came down to it, we would have just used nukes anyway. That the real purpose of creating NATO was not about defending Europe from the Soviet Union, but was in fact just basically bringing the Western European nations under American hegemony, right?
Right. Keeping the Western Europeans in tow meant that you prevented the emergence of a third independent bloc, which could challenge both Soviet and American power, and they didn't like that. On the other hand, they were also concerned about the problem of Germany, and they didn't want to see the Germans resurrect their power as they might, and so NATO was a kind of format by which the Germans could be contained. But the United States saw NATO strictly in terms of preventing a third bloc independent of the United States and the Soviet Union, and then the resurrection of German power and containing it. Now, of course, Germany is more important now than it ever seemed possible in 1947, 1950. But NATO basically is a tool of control, and of course it has no function anymore, and it's loosening its ties, and more nations are acting independently of it. But you see, you have the legacy of the Cold War. You have NATO, you have various institutions, you have a super inflated defense budget, military budget, which the weaponry is utterly useless for fighting against the kinds of conditions which exist in Iraq or Afghanistan.
Right, and you say, actually, in your book, that every super expensive weapons program that the American government creates is actually supposed to be able to fight wars on the cheap. That's the point of all this super expensive high-tech gear, is so that we don't have to stay there for generations like the British used to have to.
Well, yeah, that is one of the reasons. But the real reason is that every time you let a contract for this tactical fighter, which they're building, it's going to cost a couple $100 billion, you make Boeing and Lockheed and others very, very happy. And they have a lot of lobbyists in Washington, and they have a tremendous employment in various political constituencies, and they have loyal followers. And I'm afraid there's a good deal of pork involved.
In the book, you call it military Keynesianism.
Yeah, well, it is military Keynesianism because, quite frankly, without DOD budget, which is now $650 billion, there'll be a depression in lots of regions of the United States.
Now, so what does that mean for the audience who don't know what Keynesianism is? What does that mean to say military Keynesianism?
Well, basically, it's a subvention for weapons which are utterly useless and which will rust. But it keeps employment in various areas, and it keeps congressmen from those areas quite happy because they're very happy to see that their regions will get a couple $1 billion worth of defense contract. So essentially, we're talking about employment, we're talking about votes. And the moment the United States starts balancing its budget, it's going to have to reduce its military spending precipitously, and then, of course, a lot of people in Congress will lose their jobs, because essentially, if you take someone like Lieberman, he takes very good care of the interests in his region. Or you take the senator from Alaska, he makes sure that it's required that the only fish they eat in the U.S. Army now is Alaska salmon, et cetera, et cetera. So we're talking, or the senator from Washington, because Boeing is stationed there. We're talking now about politics. We're not talking about the world in the largest sense of the term. We're talking about keeping the system going and scratching backs. And that is simply not a rational way of approaching the world. It's too dangerous. The Americans will have to have real change in their in their political structure and in their economic structure in order to stop that from being so prevalent. It's absolutely essential.
Besides all the pork barreling for domestic constituencies, a lot of this foreign policy, especially if we look back in history, and I guess some would argue to this day, is about securing the property rights of American corporations in foreign countries, like, for example, the coup in Guatemala in 1954, or the coup in Iran the year before that.
Well, that's part of the problem, and in certain areas of the world, that explains the source of American politics. It certainly explains why they intervened in Guatemala, because if they had not been approached by United Fruit to do the job, they probably would not have done it. And that explains Central America. It doesn't explain, though, a lot of things. That is to say, one of the problems of the Middle East is said to be oil. But the point is this, is that a lot of nations in the Middle East want to sell oil, and they'll do it without an invading army. Venezuela wants to sell oil. It wants to get a better price.
Sure, Bin Laden even said, according to Michael Scheuer, Bin Laden has publicly said, hey, we can't drink it. Of course we'll sell it to you. I mean, and that even assumes a crazy like him would be the guy in power.
Well, they have to sell it. So while the United States is worried about its friends being in power, and it's often been absolutely central in various places, the people who want the nationalization of foreign interests are generally not so very dangerous. That is to say, one of the things that we're going to have to live with is the realization that the socialists generally don't mean what they say, and that they're not going to nationalize the American property, and Lula in Brazil will be a good boy, and a lot of the enemies that the United States has are enemies that they've created themselves by being very, very hostile to them. Because essentially the question is, do the socialists really mean it? And many of them are pussycats. I mean, Tony Blair, after all, is the representative of the British Labour Party.
Right.
And you have to take that into account. The only ally that the United States has is a nominal socialist. So,
well, and your point basically is that it costs a lot more to send our empire to go and quote-unquote secure these resources than it would cost to just buy them from the people who own them.
But the point, too, that I make is that it doesn't work, and it's bankrupting and traumatizing mm-hmm. American society and the American economy. Essentially, the United States loses its wars. It's losing its war in Afghanistan. It's losing its war in Iraq. If it fights Iran, which is possible but not as likely as some people think, but if it fights, it loses. And, you know, what is being asked now is that the American Congress exercise its responsibility, and if the American Congress says we don't want to lose war, instead of passing all this money, they'll simply cut it off entirely, because that's the best guarantee that the Americans will not lose wars. They'll just mind their own business. And if they mind their own business, then the world will still have problems, but it will not have the United States problem. And right. That is the situation at the present moment.
And especially when we cannot win any of these wars because they're limited wars. They, you know, like in Vietnam, the goal was never to defend America from the North Vietnamese invasion of California or anything. And in fact, it wasn't even to invade and conquer North Vietnam. It was just to protect the South from the North, which couldn't work over the long term. The same thing with Iraq. Our military didn't need to defend America from Iraq. What we're trying to do is impose the central state on these people.
Well, the most dangerous thing the United States has, and this is a fearsome enemy, is McDonald's and Donald Duck. If the United States wants to use McDonald's and Donald Duck to conquer the world, it might succeed. It's doing very well already, but it will not do so with a military machine. It will simply create a larger problem, and that is the American problem. It's a very serious one because it involves an army which intercedes, which kills people by the hundreds of thousands. But if it wants to use Donald Duck and McDonald's, it probably will do very well. Look what happened in Vietnam. Vietnam is now a pussycat. It's a society which is exporting like crazy. Or look what happened in China. It's true that in China they're now building superb missiles and there's superb space weapons, but the fact still remains that the Chinese aren't communists. They're nationalists, and this is all that's involved. And the United States will simply have to live with the world as it is, and the world as it is doesn't need war, because the United States, if it continues to pursue this course, will simply, sooner or later, in addition to doing itself damage, do the entire world damage, and that's to be avoided. That's the purpose of these books I write. But of course, to get anywhere, you have to have readership, and that's not possible.
Well, that's what the interview show is for.
Well, I hope so. But the fact still remains is that at the present time, George Bush is showing how dangerous the system can be, and he's losing. He's losing in Iraq something awful, because if anyone reads the National Intelligence Estimate of a few days ago, which was just released, the situation in Iraq is disastrous.
We're only as strong as our proxies are.
Well, even not even that. There's confusion and chaos. And what we have now, as Brzezinski, I think, has rightly said, is the worst error in the history of the United States, the worst disaster that any foreign policy has ever produced. The United States simply won't destroy Iraq. It will take apart a region which is already fragile from the World War One peace settlement, and they will take apart a whole area, and we may be living with the consequences of George Bush 10, 20 years from now.
Or even longer than that.
And you see, this kind of realization has now shocked some of the Israelis. In the last week or two, there is now much more independence being expressed there of just cutting, divorcing the United States' role there, because at the present moment, the United States is the obstacle to their signing an agreement with Syria on the Golan Heights to really neutralize Syria and make its role in the region far, far more radical and less belligerent. The Guardian had a very good summation of this by John Giddings on February 2, which anti-warcom should have given a lot of attention to. But the fact still remains is that the United States is now traumatizing the region, and if it continues on this course, much less have a war with Iran, then I'm afraid we'll be discussing this for many, many years.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very, very dangerous situation, and George Bush is a dangerous man. And, of course, George Bush has been given a 91 IQ by people who rank presidents. Cheney is the real,
well, what
the real
at the same time, though,
there.
Professor, at the same time, isn't he also very dangerous to the ability of the American government to maintain this empire at all? If I can rewind in time a little bit, you discuss in your book the lesson of the Kosovo War for the American leaders was that even NATO, never mind the United Nations Security Council, even NATO was too big of a drag on their unilateralist foreign policy. When they want to bomb somebody, they don't want anybody in their way. And you talk about how NATO has been so marginalized by the United States now that I don't know, it just seems to me that in the future it'll be harder for America to wage wars without any allies at all than it is for us to wage wars with allies who are reticent, as we have today.
Yes, you're right. But that's the hard way to get there.
Yeah, it sure is.
yes, the United States is losing its friendship. More and more nations want to be independent of it. But with the exception of Tony Blair, it doesn't have a real friend of any consequence. Well, Australia, too. But the fact still remains is that it's the hard way. Now, you want to use reason. And reason is a very good thing for people who think and don't have an agenda. But the problem is that politicians have an agenda, and George Bush and Cheney in particular, because George Bush is, well, he's got a 91 IQ, which is barely normal, I think. The problem is that these are not rational people, and unless they're disciplined by the public or by the Congress or by both or by some factor, then I'm afraid you're talking about their being disciplined by material circumstances, by fighting another war someplace which they lose again. And that's too costly in human lives.
Right.
So I think one has to oppose that. But it is objectively true that the United States is making itself weaker and weaker and more isolated and more hated. And in a perverse way, it's getting itself to where it's more and more harmless.
You say
but
we're
going to
fall sooner
that.
Or later. I guess the question is, if the longer we put off the bringing home of our imperial forces, the harder it's going to be. The consequences for America are going to be harder the longer we put it off.
Right. And then, of course, they'll bankrupt the American economy if they haven't done so already. You see, the problem that essentially we have is that there are a lot of variables here, and these make decisions much harder for the people who run the show, who have real power. They can't handle the variables. They can't handle the regional mess. They don't know what the Turks will do, or Iran or Israel, et cetera, et cetera. And each country is divided. There are a lot of jokers in the deck, like Somalia or Venezuela, et cetera. So basically, we're talking about a society which is adrift. And the United States is, well, it has too many people who shouldn't be led this way. And I think that the opposition is very important now, because it's not as if it's just a casual matter of who wins a football game. It's a question of the peace of or war for a nation and for the world, and that's just too big an issue.
Mm-hmm. And you talk about in your book, of course, the biggest threat to life on Earth is the proliferation of nuclear weapons. And it seems to me interesting to note that this policy against the so-called axis of evil is really all in the name of stopping the proliferation of weapons, and yet basically everything that our government has done, particularly with regards to Iran and North Korea, and I guess even in regards to Iraq since 2003, or 2002 even, has weakened the nonproliferation regime. It's kind of gutted the nonproliferation treaty. We deny the rights granted in the NPT to Iran, for example.
You see, the question of disarmament is a question of rationality. And, for example, the Middle East would be, because the Iranians have made it perfectly clear, if the Israelis agree to a non-nuclear zone in the Middle East, they will be very happy to have full inspection. The only thing is that Israel has to agree to that kind of situation where they destroy the bombs and the Iranians destroy their nuclear facilities, etc., etc. And the Israeli position has been that we have to have a peace treaty, which we like, with every Arab nation before we agree to that. So that's a non-starter. But the problem with the bomb is very simple. We're talking about technology. And the 17-year-old fellow in Detroit came very close to building a bomb the other week. There was a story on him in the Financial Times. All by himself. So I'm afraid the cat is out of the bag. So rather than disarmament, which would have been ideal, which was possible 30, 40 years ago, I'm afraid the most peaceful alternative would be for, and I hate to say it, but it's because it's the second best, but the most peaceful alternative would be for every nation to have the bomb. So the Israelis have come to the conclusion that the Iranians having the bomb will simply lead to a situation of deterrence. And there, just as there was no nuclear war between the United States and the Soviet Union from 1947 or 1949 down to 1990, there will be no nuclear war if every nation has the deterrent.
Well, but so, the war party says that the mullahs that run Iran are completely irrational and think the 12th Imam is coming back, and that therefore they're suicidal and can't be dealt with.
Well, they may be, but it's too late for that. Besides, there's probably as much irrationality among the mullahs as there is among the rabbis, because the rabbis also believe in a cataclysmic end of the world, and evangelical Christians believe in it. And all it is an argument against all religions and politics. But short of that happening, and I don't think it's going to happen soon, I think it's too late now for the non-proliferation route to be followed. According to the UN, 30 or 40 nations can build a bomb, and 30 or 40 nations will build a bomb. The Pakistanis have it, the Indians have it, the Chinese have it, etc. The Iranians will have it soon. If they don't already, the North Koreans have it. So, you know, that's the nature of the world. And if the United States had, 30 or 40 years ago, seriously embarked on disarmament, this wouldn't be the present situation. We'd have an altogether different reality. So we're talking about the past, not the present. At the present time, I don't think there's much chance of disarmament. I think proliferation has its positive as well as its negative side. But I think that if the United States threatens to invade Iran, they're just going to give them an incentive to build a bomb.
Yeah, although from all the news I read, Iran's technical capability to do so is still far removed, that really for them to make a bomb, they'd have to buy some ready-made stuff off the market somewhere.
Well, the head of Mossad told the Israeli Knesset, the parliament, a few weeks ago that the Iranians weren't close to it. And that's their assessment, and they are probably just as good as the CIA's assessment, which is the Iranians are not close to it. So the crisis with Iran and the bomb is completely manufactured. It's George Bush's or Cheney's last gasp. And I don't believe a word of it, and neither do the Israelis or the CIA or lots of people. It's like Saddam and weapons of mass destruction. It's just, you know, it's a lie. It's deliberate. The best intelligence is that the Iranians don't have their act together technically. But sooner or later, they will get their act together. They'll build a bomb. There's no question about it. So will lots of other nations. And the United States simply can't intervene every time a nation threatens to get a bomb, because 30 or 40 nations can build a bomb, according to the UN, and the United States can't handle 30 or 40 nations. It can't handle one. It can only create a mess, a disaster. It can only kill a lot of people, but it can't stop the world from changing in the direction which is more or less inevitable, which is the eclipse of American power, and the Americans have simply got to accept it. It's
yeah,
a fact.
That really does illustrate, I think, the whole unreality of the American imperial project. The way you describe it in the Age of War, covering basically the end of World War II through today, the whole idea behind this is that military force will solve every problem, when in fact military force doesn't solve any problems. It only makes matters worse, and we do nothing but fail. You say in the book that if it wasn't for the fact that America was such a wealthy nation, we wouldn't have been able to withstand all our failures.
No, they've managed to take a wealthy nation and settled it with an $8 trillion debt, which is pretty miraculous, because this is a nation that could have everything, potholes filled with asphalt, a good medical system for everybody, et cetera, et cetera. It could have full employment. It's managed to do the worst it can with all those resources. But the fact still remains is that it's going to have to give up its global mission. It can do so the hard way, it can do the rational way, but it's going to have to give it up, because it is giving it up. It's now unable to make its will prevail in Iraq. It's unable to make its diktat legitimate in the rest of the region, and it's defeating itself. When it does so is debatable, but I think the first task is to get rid of the Republicans, and then of course confront the fact that the Democrats aren't really much better. They're against George Bush, but they got us into Vietnam. It was a Democratic war, and it was a war of Harvard liberals. And they all went in there, and they suffered from the same illusions.
Well, and all the Democratic candidates for president at this point are on the record saying that they support all options on the table for dealing with Iran.
No, I'm not for any of the Democratic candidates for president. Let me tell you, I've always thought that the party is lousy, and that's because I watch those people, because I was at Harvard from 1957 to 62, and I watched them get into the Vietnam War, and these were all good people, and they, you know, they liked their dim sum the right way, and they liked Vermeer, and they liked the right kind of music, but they were just as bad as the Texas Yahoos, with all apologies to Texas, which is, I know, the home of the old music festival in San Antonio.
Yeah, well, it's the home of anti-war radio, too.
You're on in Austin, Texas right now. So Texas is complex, but the fact is the Democrats...
And Bush is from Connecticut anyway.
This global mission, and the Democrats have it, too. So you see, the problem is not just George Bush and Dick Cheney. The problem is American politics, and that's a tall order. I've tried to deal with it. I tried to describe it, but I don't think the Democrats will be much better, and certainly not Mrs. Clinton. She's an opportunist of the word go. Now, you see, the problem is that there are various structural factors which make war, but sometimes people are very, very ambitious, and what they say and what they do is based upon what they think will succeed politically. Olmert is doing that in Israel, and Hitler did it before World War II. And Mussolini, who was used to edit the socialist paper, Avanti, did it, etc. And Mrs. Clinton will do it, too. So we have the X factor, and that is the ambitious politician. And every society suffers from that kind of a problem. And it leads to a kind of dysfunction in running rational nations. It leads to upsetting conventional wisdom. It leads to upsetting theories about rational behavior, because when you get a politician who wants votes, the sky's the limit, and they'll say anything and do anything. And Mrs. Clinton is exactly that kind of a politician.
Mm-hmm. Now, one more thing I'd like to touch on here that you talk about in your book that really just scared the bejesus out of me, and I think ought to be a real big wake-up call to everyone in the audience as well. You focus on the fact that before September 11th and the terror war, the focus of the war party was on China. They were trying to pick a fight with China, which is armed with nuclear weapons. And I guess if there's a question here, it's whether our leaders are really that incapable of measuring risks when they're picking fights with these foreign countries?
Well, you see, Rumsfeld came to power, and he made an agreement with Bush, and it's described by Woodward in one of his memoirs. He said, "I want a forward-leaning, to quote him, foreign policy." Forward-leaning was to be aggressive. And the man he appointed to have his defense review, Andrew Marshall, was really a China man, and he thought China the greatest danger. We haven't solved the China problem yet. We have a bunch of people in Washington now who think that the Chinese are a menace. And from the viewpoint of trade, they are. They can produce Donald Ducks and stockings much more cheaply than the United States can. And the Chinese are still a great danger. So when we're all done with the Middle East, assuming that happens tomorrow, we still have the China problem. The United States simply doesn't like competitors, and they don't like nations that can shoot their missiles or their space weapons down. And now the Chinese have put up a satellite, which is the equivalent of the American positioning satellite in the Galileo. And, you have a bunch of tough guys in Washington with chips on their shoulder, a lot of chips, and the present chip is the Middle East. But when that's over, there's no guarantee whatsoever that they'll be any more rational in Asia. But the problem is, too, is that they lose control of their priorities, and the priority is given, number one, where there is shooting. And the United States is simply going to have to stop shooting. It has to mind its own business and leave the Chinese do their thing and leave the Japanese to do their thing and stop making the world think that it wants to establish hegemony. Now, formally, the defense doctrine says that they should have that hegemony. The American position has been that they don't want any kind of rival, and they don't want the Chinese to challenge them, and they don't want the Russians to challenge them. The Cold War with Russia is starting to resume again. The Russians are the Russians. Communism is gone, but the Americans are now mucking around in Central Asia. So we're really talking about getting American power to mind its own business. And in this regard, I agree with anti-war columns. Implicit respect for the Taft Republicans, because I'm from Ohio, I grew up there, and I think that every nation should mind its own business. It should be not so much isolationist as stop mucking around with the world, and that's a very good doctrine. So to that extent, I think there is a consensus with the anti-war people that the old-fashioned Republican was the safest kind of person to have in power. He wasn't very good when it came to all kinds of things like the economy, but when it came to foreign policy, was far superior to the bunch we have in power since.
I'm Scott Horton. I'm wrapping up Anti-War Radio for today with Gabriel Kolko, the author of The Age of War, The United States Confronts the World. And when you talk about America mining our own business, I guess let me try to be devil's advocate and give you the argument that I always hear from the war party, and I guess whether we're talking about Iraq or whether we're talking about the American empire on the global scale, the analogy basically holds. The war party says if America withdraws, everything is going to get much, much worse. Many, many more people are going to die, and America has to be there because or else somebody much worse will fill our vacuum.
No, that's incorrect. That's not objectively correct. There is no vacuum except if the United States creates chaos. There was no vacuum in the Middle East, which brought Iran to hegemony, because now the Iranians don't have an Iraqi balance of power. There was no vacuum except because the Americans pursued the foreign policy they have. The Americans create the problem, and I think that this analysis is simply factually incorrect. It's not that I don't like it. I just don't think it describes the way that the dynamics of history work in reality. It's wrong. The war party can say whatever it wants to, but the fact still remains is that in the Middle East, the United States has created much more problems than it has solved, and it's created, of course, the vacuum of power, which has created Iranian hegemony, and it has no one to blame but itself for that occurring. It's not a good thing that the Iranians are hegemonic, but they are, and that's due to the fact that Iraq has been destroyed and traumatized by the American invasion. All this was predicted. All this could have been was said in advance. They ignored it entirely. So the war party has shown itself to be not only dangerous to human life, but intellectually and politically incompetent, as well as dishonest, because they lied about weapons of mass destruction. They knew there were none. I think that any excuse they offer or any justification they offer for the activity should be rejected as simply specious.
Professor Gabriel Kolko from York University. He's the author of The Age of War, The United States Confronts the World. Thank you very much for your time today.
Well, I've enjoyed it very much. I hope we haven't solved the world's problems entirely, but, you know,
we've shed a little light.
Hour. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, this has been Anti-War Radio for February 5th, 2007. I'm Scott Horton. Check out my blog, thestressblog.com. Check out antiwar.com. And also check out the Scott Horton section at libertystickers.com.